I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
First, an update, a note on the high stakes and high wire acts at the United Nations. The United States and Britain are signaling this morning that they might extend their March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, drop-dead date for Iraq to show clear intent to disarm. But they also said the date won't be pushed back 45 days, as six swing Security Council states suggested. Even a month more, said White House spokesman Ari Fleischer, would be a, quote, non-starter. Don't look beyond March, said British Ambassador Jeffrey Greenstock. So maybe a new timetable, though about all that's certain is that France and Russia say they won't accept a timetable that could trigger war. No vote on any of this expected now before Thursday.
Well, Pakistan's prime minister spoke to his nation a short while ago to explain why, when the UN vote does come, his government will likely abstain rather than side with its U.S. ally. Meanwhile, that country is abuzz with rumors about military operations that could lead to the capture of Osama bin Laden. Joining us now is Adil Najam. He's assistant professor for international relations at Boston University and is in Pakistan doing research. He joins us on the line from Islamabad. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, what is the prime minister saying to his country?
On the international front, explaining why Pakistan is going to abstain, making the case that Pakistan ought to do what is in Pakistan's interest and Pakistan ought to do what the people of Pakistan have been demanding.
Well, and do you have any sense that with the revised resolutions that are being considered, the compromises, including benchmarks for Iraq, do you think that will change Pakistan's vote?
It could change Pakistan's vote. What the government has been saying and the prime minister has been saying is that Pakistan is going to abstain on the vote if it includes a war trigger, either in terms of a date or in terms of a war agreement. But if the resolution is changed and it is something that is acceptable to a number of other Security Council countries, you could see Pakistan also changing its stance. The short end here is that Pakistan would like to stand by its ally, the United States. But because of domestic reasons and because of the feelings within the Muslim world, finds it very, very difficult to vote for a war in Iraq.
Well, now to the other war, the war on terror. The ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service, held a press conference, the first ever, to talk about the arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, considered to be the number three figure in al-Qaeda. What else did they say?
They've been saying they're actually very proud of this, and this was an unusual event, and it seems that this arrest has led them to a number of useful leads, including a number of other arrests of smaller figures in al-Qaeda. But more importantly, what everyone is talking about here is an operation going on in the west of the country where the intelligence services are after a number of al-Qaeda people. And the rumor is that that might include, and I repeat, might include Osama bin Laden. Mm.
How do Pakistanis feel about his possible capture in their country?
In a way, I think the general sentiment is that it would be good riddance. On the other hand, the issue of the Iraq war certainly complicates it. The religious parties in the country have made the Iraq war their issue. But as far as the Osama bin Laden issue is concerned, I would say that most Pakistanis would consider it good riddance.
One last question, Professor. You mentioned the Prime Minister speaking to the nation. Why not the President? Where has Musharraf been?
General Musharraf has been rather quiet. And it is partly because ever since the election, he has, in fact, gone to the back row, if you will. He's very much in control. He's very much in charge. But he is allowing the now elected prime minister to be the voice of the government. This also is the first televised address of the prime minister, where he has laid out an elaborate domestic agenda and in some ways has tried to shift the focus from the international scene to the domestic scene, which many Pakistanis see with relief.
Well, Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Adil Najam teaches international relations at Boston University and spoke to us from Islamabad, Pakistan.
Kuwait is, of course, so close to Iraq that in 1991, Saddam Hussein declared it was part of Iraq. He annexed it, which led to the first Gulf War. Now, a second Gulf War seems imminent, and Kuwait is bracing for it. Its capital, Kuwait City, is just 70 miles from the Iraqi border. Tim Malloy is a reporter with the Scripps Howard TV stations who's currently in Kuwait. He joins us on the line from Camp Doha, the U.S. military base about 20 miles north of Kuwait City. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Good, Tim. Tim, what's the atmosphere in Kuwait? A sense of impending doom, or are people treating this with a degree of normalcy?
Well, I've been here for about a week, and I've interviewed a lot of Kuwaiti people. Most of them want this over with. Most of them want Saddam out. The wealthier people, and there are a good deal of wealthy people here, have left. So those who remain are genuinely concerned. There are Patriot missile batteries around the airport, around the city, and they don't want this to happen to them again. They are still worried about Saddam Hussein.
What are they worried about? Are they worried about rockets? Are they worried about chemical and biological weaponry? What do they talk about when you ask them what they're worried about?
All of the above. They're worried about a retaliatory strike because of all the American troops who are in their country, almost 300,000 now. They're worried about VX gas. They're worried about chemical and biological weapons. None of them have gas masks, and most of them complain that the people who do have them have outdated ones that aren't any good anymore. So they are concerned about being killed by Saddam Hussein. They think that they are likened to the American military. They feel that they could very well be victimized, kind of in the middle of this thing.
Tim, paint a picture for me of Kuwait City. Does traffic look? Is still traffic still moving freely? Are people still going to the kind of Kentucky Fried Chicken outlets that you find, oddly enough, in Persian Gulf places?
I was in the Sultan Center yesterday, and there's virtually no one there. And this is about as modern a shopping mall as you'll see anywhere. I mean, very elegant stores, and there was nobody in it. The streets are not crowded. There are military everywhere. There are guys with big machine guns on tops of Humvees. These are Kuwaiti military guarding the streets. And as I'm sure you know, that there are air sampling teams all over the city, some of them Czech. And they are constantly monitoring the air for chemical or biological agents. It is, now I've not been to Kuwait City before, so I don't know what it was like before, but it's a beautiful place. It seems about half abandoned to me. There's no real rush hour. In fact, I was commenting to the guy who's driving me around today, well, where is everybody? He said, well, a lot of people are gone or staying home.
Just to sum up then, Tim, how would you describe the atmosphere there? What adjective would you use?
I guess the best word I would use would be anxious and a little bit impatient, because like probably a lot of Americans and the world and Europe, there's a foot-tapping going on here. Well, when is this going to happen, if it is going to happen? It keeps being delayed. I think there's a good deal of anxiety here, and I think there is genuine fear. As unrealistic as it may be, I mean, it would be hard to imagine anything getting in over airspace here past all those Patriot missile batteries, but I think people are truly afraid and want it over and want him gone.
No sense that Saddam Hussein and his army is a spent force.
I don't think anybody I've talked to seems to believe that this is as menacing a figure as he was 12 years ago. He really knocked around the spirit of the country, and a lot of businesses went under. The little guy got hurt by Saddam. The rich people went on, but I think there was real concern that this is just as bad a guy as he was last time around.
Tim Malloy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for asking me.
Tim Malloy is a reporter with the Scripps Howard TV stations. He joined us on the line from Camp Doha, the U.S. military base about 20 miles north of Kuwait City.
A military spokesperson has confirmed there's been another suicide attempt by one of the detainees at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, bringing the total number of suicide attempts to 22. 650 detainees from 43 countries are being held at the base because of suspected links to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. On the line is Carol Rosenberg. She's a reporter for the Miami Herald. She regularly covers American military operations in Latin America. And Carol, welcome.
Well, thank you.
We know that the reports are somewhat sketchy, but this latest suicide attempt was apparently by someone who has tried it before.
We know that a number of the detainees there have made repeated attempts. I don't know if we know that this particular fellow had tried before, but we know that there have been duplicate efforts by some of the detainees there.
There'd have to be, because apparently 16 men have tried to kill themselves, and there have been 22 attempts, and apparently One of those who tried is in a serious condition in the infirmary there. You've been to the base in Guantanamo. You've seen the conditions there. What do you think the factors are that are leading to these attempts?
If you talk to the commanders and you talk to the people who work at the project, there's a great deal of despair by these detainees. But I think the bottom line reason for this kind of despair is that there is no sort of internationally recognized framework by which these guys have been held. They've been picked up. I mean, none of them in Cuba, most of them in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also in other countries. They've been brought there and told that potentially, perhaps someday, some of them could face trials, that potentially, perhaps, if they cooperate with their interrogators, they may at some point be released if they are not subject for trials or potential witnesses at trials. But there's no known framework, no charges, no lawyers. They're kept in pretty stark, but, you know, the military argues humane conditions. Small cells, single occupancy, very little time outside of them. 2 showers a week last time I was checking. I think at most 2 15-minute exercise periods a week. And, you know, people don't see an end to this. Hmm. 5 detainees have been sent away. 5 have not been sent home. One of them was transferred to the United States where he's being held in a Navy brig. 4 of them have been sent back to Afghanistan. 1 to a mental hospital is what we heard last time. The U.S. military is going out of their way to figure out how to make conditions more hopeful, and they've been building a barracks, which it would have detainees live in groups of probably about 20. They would pray together, eat together, sleep communally, have shared bathrooms. And those are for the people who the military have studied and determined that they wouldn't be a danger to the other prisoners or to the guards if they were allowed out of these cells.
Well, Carol, we should say the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes has also said that a handful of detainees from Guantanamo may be released. We don't know, you know, released to where. And isn't it also possible that with that large number of people, that many of them may have come in with mental illnesses, and who would know?
Well, I mean, the military officers who run this operation say that it's similar to any prison in America where a certain percentage do have mental illnesses and that that's expected. Certainly the way these people were picked up, some of them in combat situations, supposedly with weapons, and some of them with serious wounds as a result of explosions and bombings, could be suffering profound mental, you know, challenges.
Well, Carol, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Carol Rosenberg is a reporter for the Miami Herald who regularly covers American military operations in Latin America. She's currently based in Jerusalem.
Just ahead, new and conflicting studies on high blood pressure.
Also, direct from the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, just what is radio to Crete?
And later, why the former director of the FBI is trying to stop an execution scheduled for tomorrow in Texas.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. In the other international crisis, North Korea's recent actions, U.S. troops continue to hold the line, saying they're unfazed by what North Korea is doing. For more on that story, go to WBUR.org and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the 10 o'clock news on WB56, clear and concise with the most important stories of the day. It's the news that fits a busy life. The 10 o'clock news on WB56, Boston's 10 p.m. news leader. And Crown Books, a member of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc., publishers of The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, and Huntington Theater Company presenting Breath Boom, a new play about a young woman caught up in the world of girl gangs. Now playing, 617-266-0800. 28 degrees now at 21 minutes past 12. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In the last few months, 2 major studies of patients with high blood pressure or hypertension have been published in top medical journals. Both studies advise patients about the best treatment for their condition. That's the good news. The bad news is that the two studies disagree about which class of drugs is best. Judy Foreman is our regular medical columnist. She's here to walk us through the latest on blood pressure. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Well, first of all, tell us how important it is to know about this, because some people think they say, oh, I have high blood pressure because they feel anxious or irritable, but you really can't even tell if you have it sometimes.
No, you can't tell if you have it, and plus you're probably going to feel fine even if you have it, which is really frustrating for doctors because people resist taking drugs since they feel fine, but it's a major killer. It contributes to heart disease, stroke, and heart failure. So if you have it, you really have to get it treated.
And is it sort of as it sounds? Is it the pressure of the blood flowing through the veins, you know, can be high or low?
Yeah, and the artery, if it's too low, you die. You just conk out and die. Mm. If it's too high, your heart has to work really hard to push the blood through vessels that are too stiff or too rigid or too constricted. And that's essentially the problem. It's a hydraulic problem.
Okay. Well, tell us about these two studies, which studied two different kinds of treatments.
Yeah, the main thing is a class of drugs called diuretics versus all the other kind of prescription drugs. The diuretics, people call them water pills. They work by getting rid of excess water and salt in your system. So you urinate that out. You have less for your heart to pump around. It's very simple.
Because salt is a big problem with high blood pressure.
Salt is a biggie. And that's one thing, you know, if you want to take some baby steps toward controlling hypertension, you can stop eating salt, stop adding salt. But the diuretics are sort of a more powerful way of getting your salt and fluid balance better.
So what did the study around diuretics find?
Basically that they were as good or in some cases better than the fancier, much more expensive drugs like ACE inhibitors and calcium channel blockers, that they work just as well. That's particularly important for blacks because blacks, probably for genetic reasons, are more sensitive to salt. So this drug that works on the salt and water system really works well, and it's not expensive.
Now, there was a second study. This one did study the ACE inhibitors. And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it said what?
It said that the ACE inhibitors were better. ACE inhibitors are drugs basically that stop this enzyme called angiotensin, which makes your blood vessels constrict. And, you know, the tighter your blood vessels, the harder your heart's going to have to work. So this blocks that, opens up the blood vessels, and lets the blood go through. But what it really shows is that one way or another, you can control blood pressure, and you can start with the diuretics and then add ACE inhibitors and calcium channel blockers, or you can start the other way around. Chances are, if you have high blood pressure, you're probably going to have to take two or three drugs anyway. So it doesn't totally matter. It's great to know that the diuretics are cheap and very effective. That was the big surprise in all this, that they worked so well.
Well, isn't it a potential problem? Because if someone sees, oh, gee, the study said that water pills just work just as well, I'll just take those, and then I don't have to spend any extra money on the ACE inhibitors.
Yeah, and if they work, then that's fine. If they work only somewhat, you may need to add another drug that works through a different mechanism.
In the meantime, I think the bottom line is also don't decide for yourself. Talk to your doctor.
Absolutely. But however you do it, you got to get your blood pressure down if it's too high.
Judy, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Judy Foreman is the Here and Now medical columnist. For more, visit our website, here-now.org.
On February 3rd last month, a new radio station was heard for the first time. Across the ether came the crackly sound of a man's voice in Arabic. This, he said, is Radio Tikrit. Tikrit, north of Baghdad, is the birthplace of Saddam Hussein. And at first, the station appeared to be just another official voice of the Iraqi regime. We, the Iraqis, are betting on our nation's glorious history, the span of our civilization in the depth of history, the strength and unlimited patience of our people, their assimilation into their intrepid party, their laudable harmony with their wise leadership, and their love for the President and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. May God protect him and look after him. But over the next 2 weeks, things began to change. Many Iraqis are wondering why they should pay for Saddam Hussein's mistakes. Why should the brave men of the Iraqi army fight and sacrifice their dear lives so Saddam can live? He does not respect their capabilities and heroic deeds. He has led them from battle to battle, destroying Iraq and its potential. Saddam Hussein wants the army and the people to sacrifice their lives so he and his children live. He refuses to play any role, however small it might be, in order not to endanger his life. In its nightly broadcast, Radio Tikrit began to highlight poverty in Iraq and urged officers of Iraq's Republican Guard and Ba'ath Party officials to refuse the orders of the tyrant before it is too late. So who or what is Radio Tikrit? Well, many experts believe that the station is an American propaganda effort produced by the 4th Psychological Operations Group at Fort Bragg and broadcast from a CIA-controlled transmitter in Kuwait. They also note that a woman announcer on the station has a Lebanese accent, and the main male announcer sounds suspiciously like the voice of Information Radio, an anti-Saddam station that broadcasts from an American EC-130 airplane. The CIA has not commented. Thank you to BBC Monitoring for audio and translations of Radio Tikrit. Tomorrow on Here and Now, digging trenches and watching a serene Saddam on TV, we hear how Baghdad prepares for war.
Also, the bestseller Dante Club imagines what would happen if Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and friends had to solve a murder mystery that mimics their beloved Dante's Inferno. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, Atlantic Monthly correspondent Robert Kaplan on Yemen, believed to have the largest al-Qaeda presence outside of Afghanistan and the Pakistan region, and Eritrea, their relations with the U.S. since 9/11. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by AirTran Airways, featuring business-class travel with fares designed for the budget-minded traveler, 6 flights daily from Logan to Baltimore. For more information on airtran.com. Joby Hoy Associates, recipients of the TAB's Reader's Choice Hall of Fame Award for Realtors, offering real estate consultation or sales or rentals, 617-739-0067. At Icon Office Solutions, incorporating current technology and services into innovative solutions that help businesses communicate, 1-888-ICON-888. Meet Scott Simon. Learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour to Africa. At a free reception this Thursday night, 800-909-9287.
This is Bob Oakes. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the latest on the fate of the UN resolution on Iraq. Also, the second report in our series on homework. And a new study says the universities around Boston have been an economic engine in an otherwise sluggish economy. Those stories and all the news tomorrow on Morning Edition, starting at 5, here on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a Texas death row inmate faces execution tomorrow, even though top former law enforcement officials say he received an unfair trial.
It is absolutely contrary to all of the concepts of trying criminal cases that you do not fully disclose to the defense lawyer all of the interests and biases and statements that your witnesses have made.
Also from Texas, the discovery of shoddy DNA lab work raises questions about current convictions and past executions.
These stories and jazz saxophonist Charles Lloyd coming up Here and Now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. The president is working the phones today in his continuing effort to get support for a new UN Security Council vote on Iraq. Bush is calling President Angola this morning. That's a key swing vote on the council. White House officials say there is some room for diplomacy in setting a deadline for Saddam Hussein to disarm, but that any extension would be short. Meanwhile, the Security Council plans to open meetings today and tomorrow so that all UN members will get a chance to voice their position on a war with Iraq. As the possibility of war looms over the region, leadership in Turkey is changing. The prime minister is submitting his resignation, and so far it appears Recep Tayyip Erdogan is on the way to becoming the next prime minister. He has said he supports the idea of letting the U.S. deploy troops on Turkish soil and has hinted he would submit another motion to parliament to allow the U.S. to do so. Associated Press correspondent Louis Mexler.
Tayyip Erdogan is leader of the governing Justice Party. He's considered a very charismatic leader and a very strong leader, and U.S. diplomats here are optimistic that Erdogan is someone who has enough clout to force a resolution through parliament that would allow U.S. troops in.
Parliament rejected a similar proposal last month. 18 judges were sworn in at inauguration ceremonies today for the first International Criminal Court of the Netherlands, the world's first permanent war crimes court. President Bush has already withdrawn U.S. support for the court over concerns it could be used to wrongly accuse U.S. soldiers in politically motivated prosecutions. Supporters of the court say it will apply the law equally. An airline trade organization is warning that war with Iraq, combined with any terrorist attack in the future, would cost the airline industry billions of dollars and could cause it to collapse. The Air Transport Association said the nation's major airlines saw a 20% drop in advance bookings following the increase in the national terror alert to orange last month. The airlines want more government money in addition to the $15 billion in cash and loan guarantees that they got after 9/11. Musician strike that shut down the Great White Way is apparently over. Theater producers, Broadway musicians, settling a strike that forced 18 musicals to close down over the weekend. The main sticking point in the negotiations centered on the minimum number of musicians in orchestras. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 22 points to 7,590. The Nasdaq is up 3 points at 1,281. It's 33 minutes past the hour. This is Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Mercury Computer Systems, producing high-performance stream computing solutions for today's image and signal processing challenges, www.mc.com. David L. Babson & Company, investment advisors to private clients and institutions, working to help clients build and preserve wealth since 1940. David L. Babson in Cambridge and on the web at dlbabson.com. And the White Star Tavern, Copley Square, featuring Scott Pelletier's winter menu and awarded Best Affordable Wine List by Boston Magazine 2002. White Star Tavern, 617-536-4477. The forecast for this afternoon, partly sunny, highs in the upper 30s. It's at 29 degrees now. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with lows in the lower 30s. Tomorrow, cloudy, a chance of rain showers early in the afternoon. A breezy with highs near 50 degrees. On Thursday, it'll cloud up again and get colder with highs in the lower 30s and a chance of snow. It's 12:35.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Will an innocent man be executed by lethal injection tomorrow in Texas? Delma Banks Jr. was a 21-year-old African-American high school dropout, father of two children, when both a paid informant and a career felon fingered him in the 1980 murder of a white teenage acquaintance. An all-white jury sentenced Delma Banks Jr. to death. Tomorrow, he is scheduled to become the 300th person killed by the state since Texas resumed capital punishment in 1982. But now, a former FBI director, two former federal judges, and a former prosecutor are trying to stop the execution. To explain why, we're joined on the line by Thomas Sullivan, the former U.S. attorney in Chicago. He was also co-chair of the Illinois Governor's Commission on the Death Penalty. Hello, Mr. Sullivan.
Hello, Bill.
You're joining former FBI Director William Sessions and two federal judges in filing this brief. Mr. Sullivan, what's wrong with this case?
Well, this case is really an extreme example of a unfair trial. It's got a lot of the different aspects that often mar these death penalty cases. There's a question of whether there was deliberate exclusion of African Americans during the jury selection. It was an all-white jury. And there were two very important witnesses that were sponsored by the state at the trial. One of them was a police informant who did not disclose that fact, who later, after the trial, gave an affidavit affirming that the testimony that he gave was untrue and that he was under pressure from the deputy policeman to testify against Banks. The other man, who gave a very powerful testimony against Banks, had given a statement prior to the trial, a lengthy statement, which was not disclosed to the defense lawyer, which contained many inconsistencies with his trial testimony. None of that material was given to the defense lawyer at the time of the trial, and it is absolutely contrary to all of the concepts of trying criminal cases from the standpoint of a prosecutor, which I once was, that you do not fully disclose to the defense lawyer all of the interests and biases and statements that your witnesses have made.
And right, and there were no witnesses, there were no fingerprints, there was not much of a motive, right?
That's correct. There was testimony about a gun, and that was connected to Mr. Banks by one of these witnesses.
Mr. Sullivan, how persuaded are you that Delma Banks Jr. is innocent, or is it just that he didn't get a fair trial?
The latter.
You're not absolutely
not
persuaded necessarily that he's guilty or innocent.
Right. I have no way of judging that, Bill. That's not my purview.
So how do you stay an execution or even stop an execution for good at this point?
Well, I read in the paper this morning that the Texas authorities have refused to stay the execution. So unless the courts step in, the Supreme Court of the United States steps in today, or the Texas Court of Appeals, my understanding is Mr. Banks will be executed tomorrow.
Thomas Sullivan, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're most welcome, Bill.
Thomas
Bye-bye.
Sullivan is former U.S. attorney in Chicago.
Another case in Texas is raising serious concerns that sloppy DNA lab work could have led to the conviction of innocent suspects. The Houston Police Department acknowledged yesterday that a man convicted of a 1999 rape based on DNA evidence tested by the Houston lab was cleared when the DNA was retested by an independent lab. Joining us online from Houston is Houston Chronicle reporter Roma Khanna. Hi, Roma.
Hi, Robin.
Now, we know this retesting came as a result of an audit of the Houston Police Crime Lab back in January. Why did that audit take place?
Well, Robin, a lot of questions were raised about the quality of work coming out of that lab through various news reports, and the department ordered an audit on its own. The audit found widespread problems throughout the lab, the potential for evidence contamination, poorly trained people, and terrible, unsound technique.
How many cases might this affect, and are there any death penalty cases?
Well, they're looking into about 525 cases that were processed there, 22 of which have been ordered for retesting already. Seven of those cases that will be retested are those of death row defendants.
Well, what happens now for 21-year-old Josiah Sutton, who's already served four and a half years for this rape that he's now been cleared of because of the bad testing of the DNA? What happens?
Well, that's kind of the question we're all asking today. These DNA tests very explicitly exclude him as a suspect in this case, but he is still in jail. There are some formalities that need to occur. The Harris County District Attorney's Office has said that they are not ready to exonerate him. They think that there may be other evidence there. There was an eyewitness identification. So this is all going to have to play out in court.
One of the jurors has already said that if they had known the DNA evidence was inaccurate, they would not have convicted him.
That's correct. One of the jurors was very dismayed when he found out yesterday the results of the retesting and said that DNA evidence played a tremendously large role in the decision made by the jury.
Mm. This case obviously raises questions about, you know, the fallibility of DNA testing, not only in convicting people, but in clearing them. We've seen so many cases lately where people have been cleared of accusations because of DNA testing.
Certainly. I mean, DNA analysis is a science, and the regulation of the people who are performing it clearly needs to be scrutinized. Here in Houston, I think this is a situation of an unregulated lab with unqualified personnel, and I think that there needs to be some sort of national look at the standards that are used in DNA labs.
Is there any concern that even though the audit of the crime lab is being done independently, the review of the cases is still being done by the Houston police?
Yes, actually, there's quite a bit of concern about that. There have been some calls from within the state and actually now nationally from, you know, anti-death penalty advocates and calling for some sort of independent entity to step in and take over this work, because the Houston Police Department and the local district attorney's office is not impartial in this situation.
Has anybody been executed based on work from that lab?
Yes, people have been executed based on work in that lab, and the district attorney's office is reviewing about 55 executions that have already occurred to examine what role DNA from that lab played.
Mm. Roma, thank you.
Thank you.
Roma Khanna is a reporter with the Houston Chronicle. She spoke to us from Houston.
Still to come, a resurgence for mystic jazz saxophonist Charles Lloyd, renowned for jamming live with such 60s rock icons as Janis Joplin.
You're listening to Here and Now. Massachusetts officials are trying to determine if a particularly virulent form of strep has hit the state after 3 deaths attributed to flesh-eating disease. Although rare, strep A bacteria can cause necrotizing fasciitis, commonly called flesh-eating disease. What must that feel like? John Atwood narrowly survived this insidious bacteria, which can destroy tissue as fast as surgeons try to cut it out. He was unconscious for 2 weeks but is now awake and joins us on the line from Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. Hello, John.
Hi, Robin.
Well, how are you?
I'm feeling pretty well now.
Well, tell us about, first of all, how do you know where the point of entry was? Did you have a sore? Did you have a cut? Do you remember now that there was maybe something, you know, a wound that you didn't attend to?
Yeah, I have no idea. There's no evidence of exactly how it got into me.
And yet it's really affected your legs, do I understand?
It came in up through, they think up through my calf, even though the first experience of pain I had was in my thigh. And it really, frankly, felt like, it just felt like I had a muscle pull. Mm. I had no idea that it was a disease.
And when did you realize, I got to get to the hospital, this is something bad?
There was a point where it was just hurting so much that I said to my wife, I've got to go to the emergency room right now. I really realized there was a real urgency, and I had no idea what it was, but it was really painful.
Well, and now you wake to find that in order to stop the disease, that is a flesh-eating bacteria, much of your leg flesh has been cut away. You're a tennis player, quite an athlete. Your feelings about that?
Well, they say that there's a really good chance I'm going to make a full recovery. Hmm. So even though the surface flesh was cut away, and there was, you know, there's some surface nerve damage, there's a real good chance I'm going to be just about good as new. So I'll always have some loss of feeling from the cutting away of skin that has nerves attached to it. But they did a great job. I mean, the team of doctors at Beth Israel Deaconess here has been unbelievable. And two of the doctors, Dr. Borod and Dr. Callery, who were the key surgeons that basically saved my life, were, they were so unbelievably skilled that a lot of the skin grafts came out pretty magnificently.
Mm. Do you, how do you go forward from here? I mean, do you plan on telling people about it, or?
I'm not hesitant to talk with anybody about it. And frankly, it's hard to fathom this, but I actually, people often talk about after a tragedy, there's a there's a gift that comes out of it. And it's kind of, from the other side, looking over to this side, it's hard to fathom that. But, you know, talk to me in a year. But right now, I have to say I feel like I appreciate things in life in a way that I never did before. I love my family more than I ever did before. I feel more connected to my friends. I feel like, you know, I want to see the sunrise and the sunset and have a glass of orange juice in the morning. And those simple things are worth celebrating. And it's not like I didn't know that before, but I know it at a new level now.
Well, John, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
John Atwood, who, by the way, owns HealthFit Health Club in Needham, Massachusetts. He spoke to us on the line from his Beth Israel hospital bed in Boston.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tonight at 7 on Point with Tom Ashbrook, a look at the culture of rape following allegations of dozens of rapes and sexual assaults at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. That's tonight at 7 on Point with Tom Ashbrook. We're funded by you, our listeners, and the George Orwell Centenary Conference at Wellesley College, May 1st through the 3rd, where writers and scholars examine Orwell's influence on intellectual and political ideas. Orwell2003.com. And Fresh Hair in Jamaica Plain, a full-service salon for everyone's hair, skin, and nails. Also offering specialty products for personal grooming and pampering, FreshHair.com. Now's your chance to make a contribution for the news. Then we'll enter your name in a drawing to win a brand new Apple iBook, laptop computer, courtesy of Tech Superpowers. Enter the drawing with your $100 contribution for the news before Friday's deadline at WBUR.org. Thanks.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Charles Lloyd is my name. In this lifetime, I've always been a music maker.
Jazz musician Charles Lloyd has been tuning in and tuning out of the music scene since the 60s. Back then, the Charles Lloyd Quartet was at the top of the jazz heap, playing for the hippies at the Fillmore in San Francisco, sharing the bill with the likes of Janis Joplin and the Grateful Dead, performing at the 1966 Monterey Jazz Festival. That live recording went on to become one of the first gold records in jazz. The years since have mellowed Charles Lloyd. After the 60s, he left the scene entirely, living alone in Big Sur, California, playing music for only a few close friends. But gradually, in the 80s, Charles ended his solitude and today fills the house at clubs around the world.
Sage Charles Lloyd.
For the past year, Charles Lloyd has been on the road promoting his latest CD, Lift Every Voice. Recently, Here and Now producer April Peavy spoke with the enduring legend before a performance at Sculler's Jazz Club in Boston.
When I was a little boy, I would go around to the theaters. There was this theater in my hometown, the Handy Theater, and the bands would come to town. People like Duke's Band and Count Basie and Lionel Hampton, Billy Eckstein, Louis Armstrong, Louis Jordan. Everybody would come through Memphis, and I would go backstage because they would have the theater, and you would have a movie, and then the band would come on and play, and they would alternate like that all the time. And I'd stay all day and all evening. I was just so taken with this and so inspired. So I've been around them all. I've been fortunate to live in a lifetime when the creators of this music, the giants roam the earth, and I just, I'm still feeling so much younger than springtime from that experience.
For a period of time, you really left what you loved to do, which was play music. I'm thinking about the time after the 1960s when you were referred to as the hippies jazz man, and then you left it.
Well, you know, at a certain time, you know, if you have to charge your batteries. You know, I was just in need of charging my batteries. I was always in heavy activity. So I went into the forest of Big Sur, and I took off my clothes and lived very simple. And my nearest neighbor was like a mile and a half on either side of me. I'd play music outside. There was this beautiful canyon across from me, and with these huge, giant redwoods. I would play to the trees over on the other side of this mountain, and the sun and the sky would change all day, and it was very beautiful for me. And at first, you know, the narcotic of the applause, oh, you kind of miss something about that. But after a while, I began to get little glimpses along the way, and it was encouraging to me, because when you face the mirror of your own inadequacies, something begins to unfold. And that gave me so much when I went away. So my intuition was correct, meaning that I had to go away, and I could experience the inner silence, you see. Some sort of activities over the years. People would come around. These poets would come around, people like Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And Ferlinghetti had a place nearby. My friend Burgess Meredith would visit. So I'm living there quietly, not bothering anyone for a long time. And this little guy came through, Michel Petrucciani. He's a young Frenchman at that time. He's 17, and he's about 3 feet tall. He had a rare bone disease called glass bones. I don't know the medical term for it in the moment. And he played the piano for me, and it was so moving. So I took him around the world for a couple of years to get him started, because there he was, this young man with this great talent, you know. And people had been trying to get me to play concerts for years, and I wasn't into it, you know, in a public way. I didn't know if I'd ever come back and play in a public way again. I thought that maybe solitude was the road for me now. And so I took him around the world, but then I got bit by the cobra, you know. And then in 86, I had an internal bout with some genetic thing. So I had to have some emergency life-threatening surgery, and I didn't know I was going to make it through that. After that, I just realized that this was something that was my work, and that I rededicated my life to this beautiful tradition of this music. So I came back, and I so much still find that it's like a second coming to now come and play music for people, because I have so much better understanding of the road now in the life.
Recent CD, Lift Every Voice, you cover songs such as Amazing Grace to What's Going On, to some of your own originals. It was inspired by the events of September 11th. Tell me about Lift Every Voice, the inspiration behind it, the song selection.
That comes from deep within, and I suppose after I returned home after that time period of being in New York around 9/11, after that, I just kept touring. I went toured in the States. I toured in Europe. And when I returned home, I would sit at the piano. And these old songs from my childhood, these spirituals and such, start coming back through. And even songs far-fetched from a beautiful Cuban composer, Silvio Rodriguez, his Rabo de Nube. And it says, I wish I could be the tail of a cloud and come down and wash away all of your tears and sorrows. And when I went into New York to play, when I finally played, that was the first piece I played. Music just poured forth, and it just kept coming, and therefore it's a double CD. There's so much outpouring that I had to express the inexpressible, and so there was this inner cry to come out, you know, and I hope that the music also has uplift and touches people with hope, you know.
Jazz saxophonist Charles Lloyd speaking to Here Now producer April Peavy. For more information on his latest release, Lift Every Voice, and for a listing of tour dates, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBU.
.com.
This is WBU.